Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Chazelle Portenier, welcome.
Thank you.
We're talking about a pretty tough topic today, and a lot of people don't want to talk about it. And is it because of the fact that we're talking about female genital mutilation, or is it because it is a women's issue in a third world country or a perceived third world country that we go, and there's nothing I can do about it? Like, why is it that people want to shy away from this topic?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And what you've just mentioned are some of the reasons. You know, as soon as you say female genital mutilation, and it's a tough mouthful in any case, people just go like that, you know. So it's hard to talk about. And it's hard to talk about as well because people feel they can't do much about it. But, you know, all of that is actually not true. And the other reason that people don't want to talk about it is because they are scared.
What are they afraid of?
They're scared of being called racist. And this is the bit that I think is particularly...
Why, it's only black Africans that do this?
Well...
Because it's not.
It's not. It's an issue that concerns at least 29 countries in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the Arab world. It's recently been discovered to be happening in Russia, in Colombia, in India. However, it is part of other people's culture. It's deeply ingrained tradition in other people's culture. And people are afraid to speak up and say that it's wrong because it's someone else's culture. Maybe we should just let them get on with it. Of course, it's completely wrong because what's happening to children as young as, well, sometimes on the day they're born up to the day they before they get married. So the age range varies quite a bit.
We're not talking children. We're talking girls.
We're talking girls.
This
absolutely.
Is something that is done to girls.
It's a fundamental human rights abuse committed against girls, young girls, young children, and teenage girls, and sometimes even a little older than that.
It's a violation of their human rights.
It's a complete violation of their human rights. And you mentioned initially that people think of it as a woman's issue. Well, of course, it's not a woman's issue because the girls get married to men. And when they do get married to men, they're much more likely to die in childbirth. They're much more likely not to enjoy sex. And it's also the men that are demanding that it be done in many of the cultures. A lot of FGM is performed for financial reasons, because if a man wants a cuck girl and he has to pay a bride price for the girl, he's prepared to pay a higher bride price for girls that have been cut.
That's the economics of this?
The
father basically says, my daughter is worth more money if she's cut than if she isn't.
That, I'm afraid, is a big part of the problem.
And this is the father.
It's the father. It could be the brothers. The brothers might be saying they want their sister cut so they can get money to get their own bride. Or the parents want the sisters, the daughters cut so they get more money so they can send their boys to school. Because what invariably happens when the girl is cut, not invariably, but very often, she's married to a man shortly thereafter. And the men are usually twice or three times their age and often already have several wives.
And they will pay a dowry.
And they will pay a dowry, or also known as a bride price. That's right.
To the parents or the family.
That's right.
Do we know why this started as a practice and when?
We don't really know when it started, but it predates Christianity and it predates Islam. So it has always been not a religiously demanded thing. It has been part of people's culture. And you know, we practiced it in the West as well.
What?
Yes. Until the late 1950s, it was done in Europe and in the USA to cure women of things like epilepsy, hysteria, masturbation problems, nymphomania. So it was done to women here. I mean, there are different forms of it, but the mildest form was performed on women in the West until the late 1950s.
Oh, my gosh.
People don't know that.
That's horrifying.
It is, but it's part of our culture.
Well, then what happened here that we were able to put an end to it, and what lessons can we learn from that we can now hopefully put pressure on other cultures to say, this is a violation of these young women's rights.
Yes. Well, I think it's a clear a situation of women's emancipation and science, where it was obviously proven that even if you did this to women, the hysteria did not go away. Their nymphomania might have gone away a bit because
there'd be no pleasure left in
if there's
in
no
sex,
pleasure,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. But it certainly didn't cure epilepsy, you know.
No. So. But does it not also introduce problems, particularly in childbirth?
It does. It does. Women are much more likely to die in childbirth in countries where FGM is prevalent than in countries where it isn't. So, for example, in five of the highest prevalence countries, women are dying at the rate of 500 per 100,000. And to put that in perspective...
500 per 100,000?
Yeah.
From the operation?
No.
Complications that are associated.
Complications, yes. I mean, some of those women would have died anyway because healthcare is not there what it is here. But it is hugely increased in countries that have a prevalence of FGM. And just to put that in perspective, in Canada, the maternal mortality rate is 6 per 100,000.
6.
And in those countries, it's 500.
I've got to get you to hang on for a second while we take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
Now, the other thing, like, I have horrifying images of just the whole practice. Mm-hmm. You've got these young girls who I'm sure there isn't a single one of them that says, okay, I'm fine with this.
Well, if I may interrupt you, there are some that say they're fine with it.
They've been indoctrinated.
They're indoctrinated and they're bribed. So the parents will tell them, this is what we do in our culture. And it's a rite of passage. And after this is over, you're going to be a young woman and you're going to get lots and lots of presents and new clothes. And what young girl anywhere doesn't like to get a few more bits of clothing? Mm-hmm. So they're lured into thinking that it's harmless, that it's part of a beautiful rite, a beautiful tradition. And they're often lambs led to slaughter. Because the reality, of course, is that it is extremely painful, and they've seen their friends die, and they've seen their sisters suffer. Mm-hmm. But they kind of get swayed. As children do, they're children after all. They can be persuaded of lots of different things.
Well, it's not happening in hygienic, sterile environment that we can conceive of in a North American hospital.
No.
The conditions are...
The conditions vary, but they're often extremely crude, done by someone who has no training, and who basically wields a razor blade, which may have been used
at best,
and may have been used on more than one girl. So infection is rife, and HIV is also an issue. But increasingly, and this is what is even more worrying, really, Stuart, is that increasingly it's being done under medical conditions. So in Egypt, for example, where the prevalence is in the 90s, increasingly it's being performed by doctors in hospitals and clinics.
So it's worked its way right into the mainstream.
It has worked its way into the mainstream. Even where it is illegal, it has worked its way into the mainstream because people are prepared to pay for it.
You know, I looked at the trailer for your documentary, and there's that young girl who ran and because of her fear of getting cut. And she talks about the fact that one of her friends died, and she's afraid of that. It must be horrifying for those young women.
It is horrifying.
You've been there. You've talked to them.
I've been there. I've been to Tanzania, where I met girls who are so brave that they're risking everything, including their lives, to run away from mutilation and also, of course, from child marriage. And they are hugely afraid. But two of the girls we interviewed, we filmed in a safe house that is looking after these girls, and we interviewed six or seven of them. And two of them were extremely clear. Extremely clear. They live in an area of Africa where there are lions and leopards and hyenas, and where people like you and I regularly go on safari and see the beauty of nature. These girls are living in that region, and when they run away, they are running through an area that is populated by lions and by hyenas and by leopards. And one girl was hiding in a tree overnight with Lion's passing, get back to the point. Two of these girls said to me categorically, I would rather be eaten by a wild animal than go through FGM. And that is because they have seen their friends, their neighbors, their cousins die.
How does that affect you when you hear somebody say that?
Well, it's interesting. I've wanted to make this film for a long, long time. And part of the reason I haven't made it is because I always thought it was going to be too difficult to, to make the film. Another reason is, and it's mostly B, that I haven't got any funding for it. I still haven't got any funding. But I wanted to, but this film is different emotionally because I'm trying to tell a good news story. Of course.
You're not sitting there just telling us the horrors of
I'm not telling
FGM.
You just the horrors. Yeah. I'm telling you the story of what I call the most courageous girls in the entire universe because they're risking everything, including their lives, to run away. And so that gives me hope.
That's only part of the risks that they face going forward. Getting across that savannah to a safe house, one, they got to dodge all of these other hazards, which would I assume include human beings as well.
Absolutely. It includes their own parents who might track them down, which did happen in one story that I heard.
And bring them back.
The very girl that hid in a tree from the lion, she was with a friend. And the next day they made it to someone's house, but the other girl's parents tracked them down and took the girl home. So she did not escape the fate of FGM, and she was soon married off to an older guy. So there are those sad stories. But the beauty of the safe house and these girls is that they are risking everything. They are getting there. And the woman who runs the safe house, her name is Mama Roby. That's what the Africans call their women, Mama Roby. So Mama Roby, who runs the safe house, is one of the most charismatic people I have ever met and one of the most committed people I have ever met. She's incredible. So she looks after the girls in the safe house, but she doesn't just look after them. So they don't just run away and stay away. There is a solution at hand. It's not a Band-Aid solution.
Well, Mama Roby can't be because they've still got the rest of their lives ahead of them.
Absolutely. So Mama Roby, well, after the girls arrive, she spends the next few months going back to the village, and she and her team meet with the families of each and every girl, trying to persuade them to mend their ways, not to cut their daughter, not to marry her off, and to let her continue to go to school. And she's very successful. I've seen it in action.
This is our second break. We'll be back in a moment.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
It's
What's
absolutely
her argument
brilliant.
That works?
She has many, many arguments, but one of her main arguments is that if you don't cut your daughter, she's going to be... We have taught her some vocational skills at our safe house, like sewing, for example. So every girl goes back to the village with a sewing machine. And so her argument is, your daughter's going to come back with a sewing machine. She's going to be able to sew clothing for the villagers. She's going to be able to look after herself. She might even buy you a new house or build you a new roof.
She'll contribute more to the family this way than she would if you were to sell her off.
She would contribute way more this way than if you sold her off. And I saw it in action. I went with Mama Roby to a village to look for a girl that had recently returned with a sewing machine. We didn't track her down at the little tailoring shop where she was working, so we had to drive another 10 minutes and then walk for 10 to get to the village and to the house where this girl lived. And there she was, all dressed and ready to go to work. And her three brothers were there as well. Beautiful young men, ranging from 24 to 30 years old. So we plopped them down and talked to them. And they confessed. One of them said, truth is God's friend, so I have to admit that I really wanted my sister to be cut so we could get some cows, so I could get my own bride. But now that I see her back in the village and she's supporting herself and contributing in such a big way, we've changed our mind. And we're not going to cut her, and we're not going to marry cut girls either. So there was one family changed. It was brilliant.
Wow.
It was beautiful.
I love Mama Roby.
I love Mama Roby. I can't wait to go back in December to see her again. Yeah.
What an innovative thinker. She understood the nature of the problem.
Absolutely.
So that's a homegrown solution. It's something that somebody who intimately understands that environment and can influence change. We're more than half a world away from there. We're about as far away from there as you can get. How can we collectively here support what she's doing so that she can do more of that? And with that kind of influence, maybe we can see some real impact.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to have to correct you here, Stuart. Oh. Please forgive me.
Okay.
We're not a world away from it. We probably have 80,000 survivors in Canada who have gone through this while in their home country and who have arrived on our shores. And the real tragedy here is not the women who are in their 30s or 40s or 50s. The real tragedy is that there are lots of girls that have landed on our doorstep that had this done to them when they were in Africa, maybe at the age of 3 or 4. And they wake up at the age of 15, 16 in biology class, and they see what a girl looks like, and they realize, that's not me.
Yeah.
And for them, there is absolutely nowhere to go. There is no one in Canada dealing with this issue, helping those girls. There are no specialized clinics, there are no helplines, there is absolutely nothing. So the
And you said there's 80,000 women, young women in Canada, who have been inflicted.
Yes. Not necessarily young, just survivors. So they could be children or they could be women in their 60s or 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I did this statistical analysis myself. So it's not scientific. But I looked at the census, the Canadian census. I looked at immigration from affected countries.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at what the percentage of women were that were cut in those countries. I put it all together. And I came up with more than 80,000, maybe upwards of 100,000, but certainly I would think at least 80,000. The problem is, Stuart, that the Canadian government hasn't done any of this analysis. They are not paying any attention to this issue. They have no clue how many women are here. And they're also not supporting initiatives in the developing countries where this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big problem, because all the other developing countries are doing that work.
Oh.
UK has got helplines, hotlines, trained border guards to spot children that might be being taken back to Africa, specialized clinics, and so on and so forth.
This is a heart-wrenching topic, and I don't want to stop, but this is our final break. We'll be back in a moment.
Conversations That Matter is a not-for-profit program made possible thanks to the charitable support of the following and from viewers like you. Please visit conversationsthatmatter.tv and help us to continue to produce this program.
If it's happening at a larger number or rate in, let's say, Tanzania, and we've got Mama Robi, what can anybody who is watching this interview do to be of assistance? How can they help? One, I guess they can help you make your movie, but beyond that, also, what else can we do to educate people that this is not acceptable?
Well, they can support my movie. I mean,
yeah.
I really love them supporting my movie because my film about the most courageous girls in the world, it's not just a film. I want it to be a movement. I want
mm-hmm.
people to get involved, people to speak up. So the most important thing I think people can do is to speak up and to inform themselves, not to shy away from it, and to be absolutely crystal clear that this is not about culture. This is about a fundamental human rights abuse, and every child everywhere in the world has a right to be protected from harm. So that's the first thing they can do,
mm-hmm.
speak up. The second thing I would suggest people do is I would ask every Canadian who cares about children's human rights to write to their MP, to write to our Prime Minister, to write to Sophie Gregoire, and ask Sophie Gregoire, ask Justin Trudeau, ask their MP to invest money in the developing world, send some of our development dollars to fight FGM and to fight child marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And then also ask them, find out how many kids in Canada are at risk, how many survivors are there here, what do we need to do as a society to support them?
That's if you care.
But that's if you care.
As you pointed out, there's a lot of people who don't even want to think about this. And I'm sure that you've run into quite a number of them. What happens when you come up against somebody who goes, but why should I care? What's the answer to that?
The answer to that to me is very simple. We live in a global world. We have to care. As a species, we won't survive if we don't care about each other, if we don't stand up for each other's fundamental human rights. So it's a very simple thing to me. I know I meet lots of people who say, well, you know, that's over there, and even if it is over here, it's not my family. Well, to me, it's just not good enough anymore to care about yourself or your family or your community or your neighborhood or even your country. We have to care about other people elsewhere, especially in this day and age where we actually get so much. And we get the coffee from Colombia. We get the chocolate from Africa. We get steel from elsewhere. So we're all involved, and we have to take responsibility.
A previous guest, Patricia Lytle, wrote co-authored a book called The Hillary Doctrine. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State in the United States, she said the subjugation of women, which this is, is not only a human rights issue, it is a national and international security risk, because when you live in an environment where women are subjugated, you see tremendous spikes in violence, and they become breeding grounds for terrorism. And so if you link all of that together, we should care, because it affects the way that men in those societies act with one another and how they perceive violence.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And the other reason, of course, we should care is because women who aren't subjugated are economically much more successful. And when 50% of the population isn't contributing to the economy, you're actually condemning yourself and your country to poverty.
Well, and then add to that fact that I'm horrified that somebody could do this to another person. That's enough to stand up and say, this isn't right. But I love this approach of saying, okay, I understand the economics behind this. Here's how I'm going to help you see the world in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. And Mama Roby does see it very clearly, and she's so committed.
And through your film, you'll be able to shine light on what she does and hopefully get more of us to be able to support a change.
You know, the important thing about my film is that films have been made about this topic, and I haven't made one. But they have been made. But what has never been done before is the girls. Their voices have never been heard before. The films have been made before, and there have been some very good ones. You know, films that I admire deeply. They talk to activists. They talk to the adults. They talk to the mothers and the fathers and the woman who does the cutting and all of that. But what's been missing are the girls' voices, and our film is going to focus on the girls and bring you their stories of courage, of determination, and of clarity, because they are clear that this is a human rights abuse and they want their human rights protected. So this one young 13-year-old girl, the same girl that hid in the tree from the lion, I said to her, but you know, Janet, your parents are your parents, and even in our society, our parents get to decide what happens to us. That's just a fact of life. So don't they have a right to do that? And she just looked at me and she said, parents have a right to educate their daughters and to help them fulfill their dreams. They do not have a right to mutilate them. It's pretty simple.
It's pretty powerful, isn't it?
It's very powerful.
Thank you for bringing
voice
to this incredible struggle and those brave girls.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.